We went through the book of Judges, or most of it. So I thought, oh well, why don't we just finish off those last three chapters, chapters 19, 20 and 21 of Judges. Very briefly, this is what it's all about. We're back in that time of the Old Testament story where the people of Israel had come out of Egypt under Moses and they were heading for their new homeland, which was Canaan, or if you like, Palestine. And it took them 40 years to get there. Eventually they got there and Joshua led them in. They conquered the country and then they divided it up among their 12 tribes. They didn't get rid of all the people that they were supposed to get rid of. There were pockets of Canaanites all over the place. And it was the job of the individual tribes then to clean out these pockets of local resistance and so take full possession of their land. But they'd had enough war for the time being until they settled down and drifted along. And the problem was, of course, that the areas of opposition that they didn't clean out were eventually the areas of opposition that fouled them up. And so it gave them a lot of trouble as the years rolled on. In addition, there were nations round about who attacked them. And so the book of Judges is a story of constant chaos. There's a cycle that's repeated time and time again. The cycle is basically this. The people didn't clean out the local gods, the local peoples, and then they themselves tended to follow those gods and follow the habits of those peoples, and so they tripped up and fell into idolatry. They drifted away 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, and God punished them by allowing local peoples or neighbouring peoples to invade them and to take over control. And when the people had had enough of this, they'd cry to God, say, "We're all very sorry, repent of our sins, we're going to get rid of our idols, please send us a deliverer." And God, being very gracious, did. And so things would go swimmingly for a while, and they obeyed God again, and then they'd start to drift into the pattern of things before. And so that cycle goes on and on. And that's what this book is about, judge after judge. The word judge, incidentally, does not refer to a person who sits in a court with a wig on his head giving judgments. It was a person who carried out God's judgment on the enemy. These enemies invaded them. God raised up a deliverer. The deliverer carried out God's judgment on these enemies. He cleaned them out, and so that's why he's called a judge. And so you go through the book, Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Gideon, Jephthah, Deborah, Samson, all sorts of people who are mentioned through the first 17 chapters. And then you come to the final five chapters. The story largely is finished, and the final five chapters are something of an appendix. What they are showing us in these last five chapters is that the place was so fragmented, all broken up between these different tribes, that there was no sense of national unity, and that was one of the reasons why the place was so open to this sort of attack and why it tended to fall apart. Also, those final chapters emphasize the wayward spirit of the people, how bad they really were. They're pretty frightful stuff in this book as you read it through, and those last five chapters have got some very gory stories for the innocent. If you read them through, you get a bit shocked at some of the things that are going on there. But to let you know that not all was bad, you flip over to Ruth, which was set in the same period, and you find that there are some good things happening. There are some people around who are still following God, so it's not entirely black. But these last five chapters are rather rugged. And there are two important historical geographical points that we ought to bear in mind concerning these last five chapters. The first two, that is 17 and 18, tell us how the tribe of Dan migrated from here on the coast to there up in the north. And the second section, that's the three chapters we're going to look at now, deal with the story of the Benjaminites, the tribe of Benjamin here. I don't know if you can remember when you get on into the story of Samuel and Saul says that I'm a nothing and I'm from one of the smallest families in the nation and my family is one of the smallest in the tribe and our tribe is the smallest tribe in the nation. Well, this section we're going to look at here tells you why it was the smallest tribe. How it was reduced from a fairly healthy, robust bunch of chaps down to a mere few hundred. The way it goes is something like this. We're not going to read all the details through. I'll just fill you in on what's happening. It starts off concerning a man who was a Levite. Now, the Levites were the religious officials. They did all the religious things, cleaned out the church and swept the leaves and helped the priests open the doors and deal with the sacrifices and things like that. They were the people who helped in the general running of affairs. They didn't have any separate tribe of Levi. These Levites were scattered all over the place in towns throughout the whole of the nation. This particular fellow lives in Ephraim. He took a minor wife. That is, he had a proper wife, and then he had some lesser wives, which is not a very good thing to do, of course, but things were bad, and he had this minor wife, and you call her a concubine. She came from down here in Judah. So Ephraim is in the centre, Judah's down in the south. She was living with him up here in Ephraim, and they must have had some sort of tiff or whatever. Anyway, she decided to leave him, and she hot-footed it back to Mum. So down she came here to Judah. Well, on the way through, of course, you have to pass through Benjamin, as you can see on the map. Benjamin comes between the tribes of Ephraim and Judah. Well, husband goes chasing her, and he gets down to her house here in Judah, and he then tries to persuade her to come back. The girl's father is a rather friendly character, and he doesn't want his daughter and son-in-law to leave, and there's a rather interesting little story there as to how they procrastinated, and he tried to get them to hang on in, but eventually they said, look, we've got to go, and so they pushed off. Well, the man, the Levite, and his minor wife are now heading from Judah back up north, up to Ephraim, where he came from, and on the way they've got to pass through this area of Benjamin. They had to stay the night in a particular town. The obvious town to stay in was Jerusalem, but Jerusalem was under the control of some of the local peoples, people called Jebusites. In fact, the ancient name for Jerusalem was Jebus, and the people who lived there were Jebusites, Jebusites. They said, we don't want to stay with them because they're not Israelites. A bit racist, this thing, you see. They said, they're sort of second-class people. We don't want to stay in there in case they don't give us a good deal. So we'll go and stay in one of the good, straight, clean Benjaminite cities where we're among our own. And so they did. And they were in for a bit of a shock, because I think they might have been better off staying in Jerusalem after all. Because the fellows of this Benjaminite town were a rather rough crowd. In fact, all the people were rather rough. Nobody showed them any hospitality, and they had to go and sleep in the town square. Well, it looked that way anyway, until a chap came along and helped them out. And incidentally, the chap who helped them out, although he was an Israelite, was not from that tribe of Benjamin. It's interesting, isn't it? The lack of feeling among God's people at times. Here they are, they think they're going to get a better deal from God's people than from the others. And they didn't. They got a worse deal from God's people. And they're not the last people that have had that sort of experience either. It's pretty frightful when you think of it, that sometimes you get a worse deal from those who are supposed to be God's people than from those who aren't. And this thing of hospitality, that's another lack. It's a frightful lack, actually, I believe, among God's people. There are so many who don't seem to realize what hospitality really is. And I'm not simply thinking of hospitality among ourselves, the in-group, the church group, but I'm thinking of people in general. There's a whole lot right through the Bible, and particularly in the story of Jesus, about showing hospitality, kindness, taking in the poor and the needy, and looking after people who have various needs. In fact, it's one of the signs that a person's a real Christian. And even in the talk about eldership, it's one of the duties or one of the qualifications or characteristics, if you like, of the person who is the true elder, that he is hospitable. In this day when we're all so self-sufficient and self-contained and all the rest of it, we all tend to think that everybody's going to get along all right. Maybe this story is just a reminder to us that God's people perhaps need to take stock of some of these things. Well, as I say, the Benjaminites weren't all that hospitable, and if it wasn't for this kind-hearted character who took them in, they would have had to sleep out in the cold night air. He took them home, and they started to sit around and talk or watch the box or whatever they did, play cards or have a can of Coke. And they were carrying on quite nicely there when the local rabble come raiding the front door. These are the greatest bunch of perverts that you'll meet. They're not simply homosexual and they're not heterosexual. They're a combination of both. They can do the lot, these characters. And first of all, they want to drag out the visiting man to see if they can assault him and take out their perversions on him. Well, said the owner of the house, no, he's my guest. It didn't seem to occur to him that the lady was also his guest, but very chauvinistic, these characters. And so he said, no, not this man. I mean, don't do this horrible thing to this character. The man himself was nothing to skite about either, because you find that although he's protected, these hungry animals at the door are still after some sort of sexual satisfaction for the night. And in the end, we find that the man pushes his concubine out. He said, here, you can take her instead. Well, they did. and shut the door, and I don't know what happened except that they took her off somewhere, and then the two men were left inside and they could carry on what they were doing before, pick up their packs of cards and get back to the little chat and the passing the drinks around and so on. Heartless characters. They were looking after their own skin, and the poor lady, she got the lot. Well, eventually came 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, they went to sleep and had a nice sound sleep. Comes the morning and they think it's time to push off. Lady still hasn't come home. Anyway, the chap gets up and has his morning ablutions, and he opens the door and here's the woman lying on the step. She's dead. They'd raped her and really left her dead on the doorstep. He doesn't seem to have too much heart in him. What an odd place to sleep, he says. And he says, come on, let's be up and away. And of course there was no answer. We're in chapter 19, incidentally. This is in the Bible. It's pretty rough, but it's there in the Bible. Chapter 19, verse 28. He says, come on, let's get up, let's get going. Tut, tut, dear. Mustn't sleep you on the doorstep. But there was no answer. And so he suddenly then turned very indignant. What a horrible thing to do to this woman, he says. These wretched people, they've taken her, they've raped her, and they've left her dead. What monsters we have in this city. You see, he's all suddenly indignant. He was an absolute heel in my view before, but suddenly he's now all righteous. So what he does then is to carve the body up into 12 pieces and send a piece to each tribe. Sounds rather brutal, but that was a fairly ancient way of summoning the tribes to come and deal with a common enemy. It's not the only time you read of that sort of thing in the Bible. It's a fairly ancient sort of a practice. Rather gruesome. It got the message across pretty effectively that we really want your help because this horrible deed has been done, and so all come now and attack this common enemy. And so now he's all on the side of righteousness. I can't help thinking as I read about this character that there are an awful lot of Christians around who fit into his category. Now, I'm not saying, of course, that we can do quite these horrible things. But, you see, there's a fellow that he didn't really care too much about what these chaps were going to do. He was looking after his own skin and enjoying his night with his friend. And what happened to the lady? Well, at least it kept him safe. And he didn't seem to have too much moral fibre when it came to that. But then when, of course, he finds that this horrible thing has been done, suddenly he turns all righteous and he is now going to defend the morality of the nation. And there are so many Christians, you know, who get very indignant over some of the horrible things that go on, and they sign petitions and they demonstrate and they vote for Fred Nile and they do all these things to stop all these horrible things ruining our society, and it's decaying at the seams and it's getting rotten, and they're defending the morals of Christianity against abortion and homosexuality and prostitution and you name it. You know, the very same people, these same prudish souls, sit at home night after night, they watch garbage on the box, they'll watch stuff that is absolute tripe and trash, and it's full of all these sorts of things we've been talking about. Violence laid on, I don't know how many violent acts per 15 minutes you'd probably get, plus of course all the bedroom gymnastics and what else goes on in these things. The very same people who are very indignant about defending the Christian standards, and yet it appears to me that they're not all that much better. Except, of course, they're not doing it, but they're feeding on it, nevertheless. Now, that is basically what this man was doing. You see, when the crunch came, he wanted to fly his flag and defend the nation's morals against these things. But as far as I can see, he is lacking in moral fortitude himself. Well, I think we can probably learn a lesson from that. The result was that all Israel, in chapter 20, verse 1, gathered together from Dan to Beersheba, and they came now to deal with these Benjaminites. First of all, they summoned the leaders of Gibeah. Gibeah, incidentally, was the town where all this happened. And the leaders of Gibeah refused to do anything. That's unusual. You think that at least these leaders of Gibeah would have taken action against all these perverts that had done this horrible thing. But no, they were Benjaminites first and Israelites second, and upholders of moral law last of all. They were going to stick by the family. They were going to stick by the local tribe. You know, a lot of parochialism still around, the inter-suburban, interstate, intercity jealousies, inter-church jealousies, all sorts of things, and people are more loyal to the family, to the church, to the denomination, to the city, to whatever it happens to be, more loyal to that than they are to truth or honesty or justice. It's a horrible thing, really, but it happens in churches where, again, this sort of loyalty to families or to cliques or to the friends often takes precedence over loyalty to God, loyalty to the truth. You'll get some sort of disagreement, some tension, some problem arises, and people seem not so much concerned with doing what is right, but with doing what is going to protect the name or the reputation of my friend, relative, or whatever it happens to be. And it's pretty rampant in our society, this whole thing. Mateship, it's called in Australia. It's supposed to be a virtue. It may be under some circumstances, but people seem to think that the first requirement of people is to stick by your mates, whether they're right or wrong. And as I understand the teaching of the Bible, our first requirement is to stick by the truth, to stick by God. And in fact, I think that's what Jesus was talking about when he said about following him and becoming his disciple may mean even hating the people of your own family. Now, the word hate, the way Jesus used it, may not mean it in the vindictive sense that we understand today, but the general message is there. Your loyalty would have to be put to him first. And he warned people that if they're going to follow him, that loyalty came first. Not loyalty to the clique, not loyalty to the family, loyalty to God and his truth. And again, I believe that this is something we need to re-emphasize, because the general drift that's in society, this mateship thing, comes right into the church, into God's people, and people are motivated too often by that sort of sense of loyalty rather than by loyalty to what is right. Now, these Benjaminite leaders, first of all, they defended the Benjaminites, and they don't seem to be interested in dealing with the moral problem. Well, when the leaders of the city took no action, they then approached the leaders of the nation. The leaders of the tribe, the whole tribe of Benjamin, the elders of the whole tribe, and they defended the Benjaminites. Well, the only thing that could happen now was the people of Israel, that is the remaining 11 tribes, would have to deal with Benjamin. And so they decided they'd attack, and so this army that had been assembled out of all the other tribes now said, okay, war will follow. We are now in chapter 20. But when the war started, wonder of wonders, the 11 tribes of Israel suffer at the hands of the one tribe of Benjamin. The Benjaminites won the first round. I suppose there are various reasons for this. Firstly, they would have known their own country better, and also remember they're defending their own homeland, whereas these others, of course, don't have the same vested interest. You can just think of the Vietnam War, where Americans and Australians and others come from other countries, but the Vietnamese, who had this sense that this was their land and they were going to defend it and win it and overrun it and so on, you see, it was their land, and there was a much different perspective. It's different when you're fighting for your own country as against coming from thousands of miles away to fight somebody else's war. Plus the fact, of course, that in that type of war, superior numbers aren't necessarily a great advantage, as the Americans and Australians found out in Vietnam. When you're in that type of war, larger numbers don't always mean that you're necessarily going to win this guerrilla-type warfare. And in the wooded hills of that region, the Benjaminites, of course, probably had considerable advantage. They knew the terrain much better. And so those are various reasons why perhaps they won the first round against the Israelites. But I think there's another reason, and I want to just dwell on this for a moment, because I think this small story is an excellent illustration of prayer. Oh yes, they prayed about it. We do that, don't we? Because we're Christians and that's what Christians do. So you pray about it. Going through the ropes, the routine, because it's the right thing to do. But often not much sense of urgency, but we better do it just to make sure. And so in verse 18, this is round one. The people of Israel arose and they went up to Bethel and they inquired of God. Very religious, you see. They asked of God, what should we do? Who shall go up first against the Benjaminites? And the Lord said, Judah shall go up first. So Judah went up first and got beaten. That's a bit of an anticlimax. Well, when you come to verse 21, that tells us how the Benjaminites came out and dealt out a good beating to the Israelites. Then in verse 22, the men of Israel then took courage. Again, they formed the battle line in the same place where they had the previous day. And verse 23 now, once again, they pray to God. Now, you see, they've been a bit shocked the first time. And they realize that perhaps they took it a little bit lightly. And now their second round of prayer, they start to take things more seriously. Verse 23, they now go up and they weep before the Lord. They're not simply going through the motions now. They are giving some sort of demonstration that they mean business. And once again they inquired of the Lord, "Shall we again draw near?" And the Lord says, "Yes, you shall again go up against them." And so they went up again and got beaten a second time. Now, something's gone wrong here, because we all thought that if you prayed, God was going to answer prayer. And people have got prayer pretty well worked out. A lot of people have got it worked out in little neat boxes and automatic answers to prayer. And rub the little prayer lamp, the big genie comes and blows your troubles away. Well, they're learning that it's not quite as simple as that. And I think you and I have got to learn that. I don't think there's any particular subject that is more difficult to tie down than this subject of prayer. And whenever you meet a person who's got the solution to the whole problem of prayer and got all the answers that are going to guarantee automatic solutions and answers to prayer, then I say don't believe him, because prayer is not something that's just automatic, that you can type something into a computer and you're going to get a printout exactly as you wanted it. There's something very mysterious about prayer, and it's one of those things that the only way you're going to learn about it is by practicing it. And here we are told, first of all, I believe in this story, in round one, don't just take it for granted. Even round two, a little bit of prayer, a little bit more urgency, but they still hadn't really grasped the fact that it wasn't quite as simple as that. And so after round two, again, they get defeated. Well, now they are really reduced to nothing. In verse 26, we now come for the third round. Look what happens this time. All the people of Israel this time, the whole army, goes up to Bethel, and they weep, and they sit before the Lord, and they fast all day until evening, and they offer burnt offerings, and they offer peace offerings, and then they inquire before the Lord.
Please turn the tape over at this point.
Then they inquire before the Lord. Now, here they seem to be reduced to the point where they realize you no longer can take God for granted. You can no longer breeze through your prayers as if you've done the right thing and answers are guaranteed. There's a sense of urgency in the whole thing. And I'm sure that you and I have had this sort of experience. And there's nothing like some crisis or some particular set of circumstances going haywire. Nothing like that to really drive us to true prayer. And suddenly a sense of urgency creeps in. Suddenly we realize that we mean business. And we do really sort things out with God. And no longer do we just cruise along as if prayer is just one of those things we do because we're good, straight, evangelical Christians. You find as you follow the third round through that they did in fact win the victory. But only after a lot of planning. The very fact that they prayed so earnestly didn't mean that they could then sit back and say, well, God's going to do it all for us. On the contrary, they planned even more thoroughly than they had before. No longer did they take it all for granted that victory was guaranteed. And then you read it on, and you find from verse 29 that they then planned a very careful strategy. Well, I'm not going to go through the strategy. It's there in great detail from chapter 20, verse 29 through to verse 36. And then you get a further detailed account from verse 36 to the end of the chapter, which concentrates more fully on the actual attack itself and goes into the details of how they worked out their ambushes, the secret signs they arranged between them. In fact, it's probably given in as much detail as any account of any battle in the whole of the Bible. The upshot of it all was they won. Well, once again, I trust that the general significance of this in relation to our own response to God, our own devotion to God, our own prayers, I hope the lesson is not lost on us. However, the very fact that we do something and that we get God's help is no guarantee that we ourselves are going to behave correctly in what we do. And it seems to me that these fellows of Israel then went berserk, and they went far beyond anything they ought to have done. Not only did they carry out the attack on the evil people of Gibeah, They carried it right through Benjamin, and when you get to the last two verses of chapter 20, you find that they slaughtered the beasts, they slaughtered the women and children, and they left the place in a heap of ash and rubble. And then in chapter 21, they meet a problem. And whenever you overreact, you're always going to meet a problem. One of our great problems is that we never know when to stop, particularly in the matter of punishment or discipline. I believe that authority is something that God has implanted in the very fabric of human life and human society. And God has given authority to people. He's given authority to people in society, to governments, to law enforcing agencies. He's given authority in the church, to leaders in the church. He's given authority in the family, to parents. He's given authority right through the whole range of social relationships. But the big difficulty is handling that authority properly. We know as parents, or as leaders in church or business or secular activities in general, we know that it may be necessary to exercise authority. And the big temptation then is to see oneself as God almost, and then to go in a heavy-handed fashion and go beyond the limits. That is one of the repetitive themes in the Old Testament. God used this nation, God used that nation, God used some other nation to punish Israel. And time and again he comes back and then has to deal with that particular nation, because time and time again they went beyond what was reasonable. And here again we find that these people went beyond. And I think that all of us who have some sort of authority must always remember that we are answerable to a higher authority, as Jesus said to Pilate. Maybe the authority is given by God, but that in itself is a reminder that we are answerable to God for the exercise of that authority. Knowing when to stop. Well, these people didn't know when to stop, and they virtually wiped out the tribe. All that was left was 600 men, and the rest, gone. Now, the rest of the leaders of Israel, they're very indignant over the horrible deeds that these people of Benjamin have done, and so they take a vow upon themselves that they will not give any of their daughters to marry these filthy Benjaminites. That's in chapter 21, verse 1. The men of Israel had sworn, cross the heart, swear to die, hold the hand up, and all that sort of thing. Not one of us shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin. No Benjaminite will marry one of our daughters. They are filthy. That's the Benjaminites. And the people came to Bethel. They sat there till evening before God. They lifted up their voices and they wept. And then they said in verse 3, O Lord God of Israel, why has this come to pass in Israel, that there should today be one tribe lacking in Israel? Sounds very pious, doesn't it? Well, I tell you why. Because they wiped them out. The ones that are praying the prayer, they were the ones that had just operated this great bloodbath. Massacre. Unheard of in the history of Israel to that time. Massacre. Not of enemies, but of their own people. They had to deal with the Benjaminites, but not to that extent that they virtually wiped out the whole tribe. And then in verse 6, the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin. Ah, you see, starting now to realize that perhaps they have gone too far, and they're feeling now a little bit sorry for these Benjaminites. Well, they said, what are we going to do? Because if we don't get wives for these 600 men, a whole tribe is going to disappear. Now, they've already crossed their heart and said, we're not going to give our daughters to these Benjaminites. Well, where are the Benjaminites going to get wives from? And now the ingenuity of good religious people comes in handy. We're very clever at times. Religious people are very clever at working out tricky ways of doing things and somehow salving our conscience and thinking we've kept inside certain legal requirements. So they hatch up a little plot and they say, well, who didn't come to the battle? And they do a general run through the roll call and they find the people from Ramoth Gilead over here hadn't come to battle. And they said, right, let's take it out on the men of Ramoth Gilead. And so they launch an invasion. And they attack these people in chapter 21, verse 11. And they say, we're going to kill everybody except the nice young ladies. The virgins, the ones that would make ideal wives for these men, they obviously are excused because they've never got themselves into any sort of complicated situation. They are not guilty of any misdemeanors. And so we can't blame them for not coming to battle, can we? So they wipe out the rest of them and they pick up on the way, verse 12, 400 young ladies. So that's one way of getting around their conscience. They got round the little oath by picking up these 400. Only 200 to go. 200 men still don't have wives. And then you come to the end of the chapter, and this is a Bobby Dazzler. How they worked out that they were going to get the remaining 200. And it's the greatest put-up job you've ever read. What happens is they come to the men, the leaders of Benjamin, and they say, well, look, now this is what we'll do. And so the fathers of all the young ladies around town and the leaders of Israel, they sit down, all very serious about it, and trying to convince everyone that they were straight. But it was a straight put-up job. It was a charade. It was a mockery, really. But with all seriousness, they said, well, what we'll do, we've got this feast coming up at Bethel or wherever it was, or Shiloh or somewhere. Anyway, this festival's coming up. Now, they said, what we'll do is, you 200 fellows, you can hide here in the vineyards or somewhere like that. And when all the ladies come dancing down, we'll make sure they come dancing down the road. Don't you worry about that. But when they come dancing down the road at the right time, it's sort of seven brides for seven brothers type of thing. They're all going to come out and grab one. And now in that way, nobody has done anything really wrong, because we didn't give them to you, did we? I mean, we haven't broken our oath. So we can't be accused of going back on our word. And you fellows can't really be accused of taking captives in war, because the Israelites were told not to go capturing all the young ladies in warfare and bringing them home for their own pleasure. And so you haven't really done that, because it's not really a war, is it? No. Okay. So that's what happened. And everybody was happy, and the 200 men got their wives. Strange creatures we are at times, the way we can rationalize things. But it's all there in verse 22. This is the end of the story. When their fathers or their brothers, that's the brothers having, of course, some sort of say in family affairs, when the fathers or brothers come to complain to us, this is the elders, when they come to complain to us, we'll say, grant them graciously to us, because we did not take for each man of them his wife in battle, did we? We didn't just whip them off as if we were soldiers lustily getting the young ladies after battle. No. And neither did you give them to us. If, of course, you had have done that, you would have been guilty. But you didn't give them, you see. They just took them. And so everybody was happy, and they all got their wives, and they lived happily ever after, or something like that. Well, we smile when we read that, don't we? Well, boy, I could tell you some funny stories around some churches. The way people rationalise things. You know, they've got all these little ways of rationalising things, that a certain thing is right in this meeting, but suddenly it's wrong half an hour later, because it's a different sort of meeting. And, oh, but they've got a little way of explaining it. God has gone out the door, or God has come in after the first meeting was finished, and God was offended over that, but he's not offended over this. You know the sort of thing I'm talking about? I'm not going to get too specific. I think you've all got imaginations, and you can work out a few things. I'll give you a lead in, though, because it's sufficiently far away and unrelated to this church not to be any sort of criticism. It's out of date, hopelessly out of date now. But just a simple story that could be repeated many times over. It goes back 15 years or so, when I was home on leave from Thailand once, in the days when it was rather radical to be showing slides in a church on Sunday night. And this particular place, the elders came and with much gravity they explained that they'd never really had anybody showing slides in the gospel meeting on Sunday night. However, they had had a talk about it. Look, they were so serious about it, explaining the deep theological significance of their decision. And they said, what we're going to do is that we'll have the meeting from, it was a 7 to 8 meeting, of course, they'll have the meeting from 7, and we'll finish it at 20 to 8. And then Brother X will come up, and he'll close the meeting in prayer, and then you can show your slides afterwards. Now, I don't know if they thought God didn't hear them cooking this one up, or whether they thought God had gone home with a closing prayer and he would no longer be offended by these slides on Sunday night. Okay, we laugh at that. I'll leave it at that, and I'll just let you think about some of the other anomalies that exist. How we seem to have double standards at times, don't we? We twist and squirm around, and we're just like these people. And with all the solemnity in the world, we come out with these little arrangements that seem to satisfy the legal requirements. That's what legalism's all about, you know. The essence of legalism is satisfying the external requirements and very often fouling up the spirit of the whole thing so that we can do what we want to do and at the same time somehow keep the thing legal and above board. Well, there it is. One or two little points along the way there that I hope might be a reminder for us. Human nature is a remarkably deceptive thing. I think it was Jeremiah who said, "The heart of man is deceitful above all things." And here we have a few examples of it. And while we laugh at them, I think every one of us would have to admit, whether we think of church, let's think aside of church for a while and think of our own personal lives. I think we do the same sorts of things at times. We're very clever at rationalizing things we want to do and dressing them up in religious language and getting a chapter and verse to justify it. And here is just a reminder that it's not necessarily the way of God. The chapter concludes by telling us that in those days there was no king in Israel and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. That's the theme of these last couple of chapters. The fact that the place was chaotic and that there was no central government, and I think it's tacked onto that story to point out that there was no use anybody complaining. No use any of these girls complaining, or their fathers, or their brothers, or anybody at all complaining, because there was no way of gaining elementary common justice. That was the sad situation, and of course that deliberately is there at the end of the book of Judges to prepare people for the book of Samuel that follows, and then how the kingship came into being.